So he bangs up against there, and this force meets him equal and opposite on the other side. On that point comes the solar plexus. And there, just as in the child developing in utero, there had to be a flash. So here, at this point, there is a special kind of flash. A new possibility where the old hellish serpent locked up below the diaphragm, at this point, can strike a light, a special kind of light. You will notice that if ever you feel a sense of loss and you place your consciousness there, you will feel the depression in the solar plexus. You'll become aware that all losses are registered there. It is where the serpent's head is lifted. Now, you know what a serpent looks like, a cobra, and hissing especially. That is exactly like the stomach, swelling. There's the food tube coming down, and as soon as it breaks through the diaphragm, it swells out like this. You see? There's your cobra head. And it is trying to force itself up. It is being met. And it cannot get through. So it pushes its tongue up, it extends, and says, I must speak. I must voice myself in the enemy territory, where intelligence absolute is spreading. He said, but I must secure for myself a voice. And so the voice is an outgrowth of the vice. And the only difference is the O. Everything that is devilish down here below the diaphragm, as it becomes aware of this dome, which is this O, conceives out of vice a necessity for voice, and climbs up and articulates and says what it wants. And while it's busy saying, I want, this inexorable absolute is coming down and saying, I am washing you, free from your wants. Because, dialectically, you have cut yourself from this wisdom and committed yourself to learn only through pain. So here's your pain record. Looking through the eyes to see if that's another drawing pin or another gentleman or another lady or whatever it was that caused the pain. And then this is crying and saying another one of those horrible things. Don't go. We've said before that this serpent down here is either positive or asleep. It never says no, it only says yes or snores. Down there is the pure positive of appetite. And here is that same thing lifted above the dome of the diaphragm and rationalized as pleasure and pain. The Greek word phren, from which we derive schizophrenia and so on, means mind, but to the Greeks it meant the lungs and all the zone of the diaphragm and above it. So the phren is this part of the judgment mechanism which has to do with pleasure pain, whereas the nous, the Greeks placed in the head, deriving information from the absolute as opposed to the five senses. So there's the nous or Yorkshire nuts, and here is the phren down here where one becomes frenzied or tortured by likings and dislikings. And here is the dome or firmament over the hell. Now we said we'd talk about the states of this appetite. We'll call it more, M-A-W. M1 means more in its first state, M2 more in its second, M3 more in its third. More in its first state is more with nothing to eat. And it is in a state of profound melancholy. You might have seen some alchemical references to this, or even drawings of a lady sitting in the dark with her head between her knees and her arms around her shins, looking very miserable. There's nobody there to eat. This is called M1. It is represented as a woman, because woman represents the volitional side of man, as the male represents the ideational side of the human. So as Adam was created male and female, so in Adam there are two aspects, volitional, appetite, that's the female aspect, and ideational, formal content, the male aspect. And therefore, when we come to consider all things to do with the feelings and the appetites, we have to say it belongs to M. And we translate M as Mary. So we say this is Mary 1, or Mary 2, or Mary 3, or shortly M1. Now, M1 is when there is nobody about. So you can guarantee that unless you've got a keyhole, you will never experience it. If ever you find an M, it could occur in a man. Remember, we are hermaphrodites. And therefore, a man could become willful and sulk if he wanted to, as well as a woman. And if he did so, it would be the woman in him that was doing it. If he were in a room on his own and didn't know that we were watching him through the keyhole, and he sat down in complete despair, we'd say, that is genuine M1. But if he heard us for a moment flickering our eyelashes at the keyhole and thought he was being watched, immediately he could no longer be M1. He would convert into M2. M2 is symbolized by Mary Magdalena. Mary Magdalena was a prostitute, or fantastic lady. She sold fantasy. When the appetite, which previously had nothing to eat, there was nothing in the environment, suddenly sees food approaching, usually on two legs, it suddenly becomes fantastic. So if it knew that we were watching through the keyhole, it would alter its behavior. From being horribly ugly in its misery, it would suddenly become gracefully miserable. This actually happens, suddenly a change of poles. This is why we say that consciousness is a catalyst. Because a person that's in profound dejection, I once set a little experiment for a fellow I know who didn't believe the M123 relation to be true. And he said that he would like to test it empirically. So I told him that if ever he'd seen his girl miserable, she was M2ing, she wasn't M1. And he must devise an occasion when he could spy on her, definitely without her knowledge, while she was being in despair. So he waited about 8 years, and eventually he caught her. And to his amazement, she was sitting there with her legs wide open.
She was on there.
And he thought, that's it. You see, she was sitting with legs akimbo, scurrying away. And then he remembered that I'd said that if she became aware of the slightest sound that might suggest she was being overlooked, that there'd be a change of posture. So he just went, little cough. And at that moment, she apparently didn't move. But suddenly, she wasn't ugly anymore. The ankle came out, the foot arched. She was gracefully curved. That was M2, you see. As soon as the maw knows there's a possible dinner, and it's got to be lured to it, you know, there's a kind of spider that eats its husband, then it becomes very, very graceful. So that the dinner will go out and say, my dear, you're looking terribly sad, and pat it on the head and lose a hand. That is the stage called M2. Now, that is Mary Magdalena. She is the fantastic lady that Christ converts from her naughtiness. And only Christ can. The rest of us are trying. We must get this Christ, the absolute logos, consciousness, before we can convert M2 into M3. Now, M3 is the mother of Mary. That is, the three is a triangle. The equilibrated maw, the perfectly balanced appetite. In the first state, the maw is one, and there's nothing to eat. So it divides itself, two means duality. And it divides itself into dinner and eater. Remember the Samson riddle we said was so very important. Out of the eater came forth meat. The eater is the appetite, the primary appetite, the universal wolf. And it simply rolls itself into a ball to make itself a dinner. And the part that's been rolled into a ball becomes egotistic and says, I'm not your dinner, and runs off. And the part that is rolling it into a ball says, but I rolled you up. And a metaphysical argument ensues, it's not finished yet, as to which side of the debate is correct. The moment that the absolute energy, which is more, it has this quality of being appetite, divides itself Then there is a relation of more powerful, less powerful. And the more powerful then proceeds to eat the less powerful and define it as dinner. And the less powerful rushes off, defining itself as a believer in freedom. The division then causes a terrific chase. You remember the Hindu concept of God sitting on his own and suddenly becoming afraid and said, I'm alone. So he said, I will make for myself a woman. So he rolled up a woman. And then he got hold of the woman and said, we will now make a universe. And she slapped him and said, you can't do that to me, I'm you, and ran away. And he pursued her and she changed herself into a tigress. So he changed himself into a tiger, and out of that came all the striped pussycats. And he then changed himself into a deer, and so on. This is the metamorphosis of will into all the forms. You get it in magical rituals, where one magician pretends he's a butterfly, and another one pretends he's a bird and eats him. As soon as he eats him, this one says, ah, I changed myself into Basilus Crawley, now eat me. And then a battle goes on inside, you see. He becomes a bacterium and he becomes a bacteriophage, and they go on chasing you down the nights and down the days in this manner, until eventually the sum total energies of the chase overheat the pair of them and they incandesce. They suddenly realize it is self chasing self, and at that moment it becomes M3, the perfectly equilibrated appetite that is aware that it was chasing itself, and there's no sense in running away oneself. And if one can eat oneself without resistance, it is possible to enjoy a meal. And this process of self-eating instead of trying to eat someone else is what we mean by continence. To take the energies that come in and eat them. And not to try to get hold of the source, the imagined source of them, but simply to eat what you've got in yourself. To make no attempt to make incursions into other people's territory. But if anything comes into you, eat it and contain it. And this is the process that has to be learned, the process of self-eating. This is how Samson, the son of the seed, grows into the powerful macrocosmic being, pulls down the temple, the time play, and thus attains his absolute majority. So down here below the diaphragm is this serpent, where there's nothing to eat. M1, it's very miserable. When you set before it special optics, which it's got here, for gazing at dinner, then it starts going nice little gestures and little chuckles come out from here, dim dim and so on. And it begins to send messages up and they go out to the arms and bring it to. All this fantastical display is part of M2. When it finally reaches flashpoint in the fight between eating and being eaten, it converts into the enlightened will that knows that it has always been an appetite, that there is nothing other than this appetite, which is absolute energy, that energy created for itself by rolling up energy into a ball, its special one meat ball. And in the process of doing so, of gaining this enlightenment, there's no more chase. But when an individual gains that level of no more chase, he has not saved all the other individuals. So they will still go on coming to him and trying to capture him and eat him up. And as they're coming and trying to eat him up, they're stimulating him. And their attentions are more food. And he doesn't want more food. And the less he wants, the more he'll get. It's a dialectical rule. If he seeks to preserve his petty little five-sense ego, he will lose it. But if he's prepared to lose it, he will gain this sixfold, absolute one. So when we consider the whole process, as you gain in integration and continence, so you are ceasing to be a reaction system for other people. Now, it is a psychological law and a physical law that there can be no action without a reaction. And if you do not get a reaction on your own level, you will starve, literally. So if an egoic individual of the five sense order
insults you and you don't respond, he begins to die from that moment. So to preserve his life, he will try to break down your resistance. If he fails completely, he will run away and not bother you again, because he will lose his life. Unto him that hath, unto him shall be given. To him that hath not this, even that which he hath, that will be taken away. Because he can't help at that level of the five-point man. It's trying to stimulate other beings. And that energy of stimulus that he uses, he has lost, unless he can produce a reaction back from that being. So you'll notice that if ever you've tried to insult anybody, and they've immediately been tremendously upset and flashed back at you, a warm glow of delight has begun in the epitometic zone below me. That got him. That got under the skin. Now that glow is nothing but the feedback, his reaction coming into your organ and feeling it. On the other hand, if he just looks at you and he goes out of focus and carries on reading, there's a sensation in the solar plexus of dreadful loss, misfire. You see? And you've paid energy out and none has come back. And he's grown and you've diminished. Like John the Baptist says, I must decrease and he must increase. This is like John the Baptist and this is he who must increase. So in the whole process, we have an indication of what we've got to do. In every situation, every day, some individual will try to get underneath our skin. If we allow a reaction out, we diminish and they are fed. If we manage to inhibit it, they will diminish and we will be fed by this. And they will go away and gather their forces together for another try. If after a number of tries they have failed consistently with you, they will go away completely. And in the process they will try to annoy somebody else, because if they fail to annoy anybody whatever, they will perish utterly, as the hare said. So let's think about the practical application now. Tie the rope around your neck. Gentlemen wear a tie. The origin of the necktie of a man is just as a mnemonic device, something to remind us by a little movement here that we're about to say something, we're about to react. Civilized men tend to react by saying something, uncivilized men by doing something. As we're supposed to be civilized, we wear a necktie to remind us not to react. So if we wear it fairly tight, I know it's not down, it's a bit teddy boys, but if we wear it tight like an early priest used to do with his rope around his neck, as soon as the larynx moves, it has to adjust itself and lift a little bit to put the ring cartilage at the base of the tongue on top of it. As soon as it moves, then let that movement be a reminder, shut up. We've just gained some energy. And in that moment, the awareness that you've gained energy will help you to shut up. Whereas if you thought that you were shutting up for nothing, or that the other fellow is gaining a point if you shut up, you will speak. So the important thing is to realize that if you speak, he will gain. And if you can shut up, you will gain. And in this process, you're told in the Bible, if you do this, you will heap coals of fire on his head, because his brain will go very, very quickly, round and round and round, it gets hot straight away, because it's looking for something to say to compensate for the last misfire. We're not supposed to heap coals of fire on people's head as a deliberate policy. To do that would be to lose. Never mind the ethics of it. If we thought, well, I'll heap coals of fire on that bloke's head, we'd first have to expend energy on him to provoke him to provoke us. And it might misfire. So any deliberate attempt to put coals of fire on his head must fail. So we mustn't do that, not because of any ethics, but because it's bad mechanics. Ultimately, every ethical proposition is a mechanical proposition. Every moral postulate is just an efficiency postulate. So So we have to remind ourselves of this all the time. Energy coming in through the eyes, a little wiggle of a pelvis, whether with or without skin on it, whatever it is. But it goes in, it starts a process in here, and tends to produce something here. Catch it, inhibit it, save it, and know that it is yours if you don't let it out. And know that until you have practiced a lot, until you've engrammed on your substance, that it is a real loss if you let it out, and a gain in substantiality and real being, and eternal substantiality. You're building immortality. When you've recited that often enough, it will be easy for you to inhibit that response. When you recite it often enough, you will respond, and every time you do, you'll feel bad, because you know that you've lost energy. Certainly in this room, we cannot claim ignorance. Concentrated and produce a plurality of beings, in order that each being shall be driven down to hell, its pressures increase so that it can and cannot back a reciprocal center of the absolute. Now the whole process is perfectly simple. From the energy point of view, we are finite systems. We want to increase power, increase consciousness. Every time a stimulus comes from another being or from a situation, if we see a beautiful landscape, it is energy feeding into us. It has associations and centers. If we lift our hands to the sky, like a little spinster might do to herself, and appreciate it internally, she groans. And if we go all artistic on it and say, well, a smashing sunset, we're losing some energy in the expression. So if we allow it to come into us and don't let it out, we are growing. And this is selfishness of the highest order, as opposed to selfishness of the lower order that's always letting the rubbish out onto other beings. We want the higher selfishness, this selfishness, the six-pointed selfishness as opposed to five-pointed. And let's recap this state of the more. When the appetite, that is the will, in a man or a woman, has nothing to eat, nobody to batten on, nobody to annoy, nobody to chew, and so on. It is profoundly miserable and also tremendously ugly. Because really the appetite without it is very, very ugly. Because he's got no reason to be otherwise. It's not a moral statement. It is ugly because it is turbulent in a staccato manner. It is impulsive and grabbing at its potentials in all directions. There's no real coordination. But the moment a potential meal appears on the horizon, its behavior immediately becomes rhythmically attractive to bring the din-din close to. And remember, we're talking about the human being in its dual polarized aspect, man-woman. Every man has a woman inside him, every woman has a man. The nervous system in a woman is a man. The belly system in a man is a woman. We've all got both. If we manage out of our disappointments and thwartings of our appetite in the Magdalena or fantastic state of our will, trying to attract the dinner, if we manage to suffer enough, we will create heat, friction, energy, and don't let it out, and it will crash through all the barriers and become an illuminating brain. And at that point, the appetite has converted itself. This is the great Om. This more now has gone right to the limit of being and written itself as an inflexibly self-conscious magician or magician. Remember the word magic is from the Moh, the primary appetite elevating itself, substantial appetite activity, grossly established in a material body, intellectually formulated and applied consciously. Magic is simply the whole process of the development of the will. Is there any aspect of this that could do with clarification? Yes.
Which is the higher one, which you said, of course, is the more developed. That's the basic one, isn't it? Where you just retain the energy, actually, the which is sieve concerns aviation and everything, isn't it?
Yes, so remember the sieve itself is the formal grid of the energy. How can the which is a WH, an entity with Ichiha in it, a will to something, Ichiha is will, it's precipitation on points. The sieve is the formal grid of the absolute. How can the which, that is the being with the itch, to manifest, go to see, that is the cosmic Mare, the Mary, in the sieve? The answer is block it with clay. That's the real witch. Clay is your gross material body. If you don't have a gross material body reference center to which you can constantly refer, then you are fantastic. The whole purpose of getting a physical body first is to get a persistent stimulus to which you can refer and integrate all your ideas so that your idea body grows out of your physical body as a continuously present stimulus. So that's putting the clay in the sieve. That's putting your gross material body inside the grid of form of the action. And sailing on the sea, Mare, the cosmic ocean, of experience.
One question I'd like to ask. The Sanskrit definition of alice appears to be more profound than all the others. Does that mean that Sanskrit was not a general language, but a priest language?
It was a priestly language, yes.
Seems to be far more profound than the others, doesn't it?
You can actually infer a nation's philosophy from the word they use for I and me. I will give you the whole of their subjective philosophy, and me, their objective philosophy. You see, there are two aspects, the observer and the observed. The absolute reality has aspects to a finite being. It has no aspects to itself. It is solid being, absolute substantial power. You cannot divorce the substantiality from the power aspect. So Sanskrit was a priestly language, and in it, therefore, the terms were very, very carefully considered. And remember, Christ says, out of the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaks. This worm banging up against here is creating, when it breaks through the diaphragm with its tongue, pleasures and pains, trying to get back. But every time it meets a situation and the external stimulus is painful, it goes back into the spinal nerves and climbs up. And then sends a message down here to say something about it. So when this region is full, then this mouth will speak. Your emotion, this is the emotional place. Down here is the appetite, urge, volition, unconscious. When it breaks through the diaphragm, it is already becoming ex-motion, moving out emotion. And when it fills this zone, you notice that people who've got a lot to say take a deep breath when they say it. And they compress themselves around here because in this center one feels superior to the hellish aspect of the being. So if you ask a man to put his consciousness in the chest and say what he feels, all do it, just lift your chest and breathe in and just hold it a moment and feel how you feel. We'll all feel the same about this. If we're perfectly honest with ourselves, we feel fine. We'll feel as if we're capable. We'll feel dignified and decent and ideal. If we carry our weight on the ribs, to test that feeling, just let the ribs fall, relax, let your tummy stick out, pull your consciousness low down, and see what you feel like then. The ideality is gone. It's dropped. Test that by pulling the consciousness up, by lengthening the spine with the consciousness running up the spine right to the top of the head and lift yourself up like that. And when you're up at the height, notice that you feel impersonal about it. your ideality feeling isn't there, but there's a total awareness feeling over the head. And then deliberately bring it down to the space between the eyebrows and center it there, and you will immediately feel a peculiar kind of authority with a potential aggression in it. Can you feel it? Get used to those centers in your body. Because when you're not watching yourself, you tend to fall, literally. The consciousness drops down the body. The spinal posture goes. The ribs collapse. The tummy sticks out, and so on. The whole thing falls, and that is the meaning of the fall. Put your sky hook on, pull it up, gently, you know. Correct spinal posture is the key. There's no other posture in yoga, actually. In the classical, original yoga posture has only one rule. That's the rule. The spine must be correct. It's to do with the play of forces around the spine. If you allow the spine to go like this. You see, actually, the physical cord is out of line with the field. And it must be in line with the field. The moment you rise that line, you feel better. You are better. And your nervous energies are flowing, and that is the only rule in yoga asana. Namely, spinal posture must be correct and easy. Nothing else. If you cross your legs behind your ears, whatever you do, it will not produce spirituality. But if you can remember to keep the spine long and keep the consciousness up there, except for moments of command, then you will be super individual. And if you bring it down there because you want to say something meaningfully, you'll immediately feel the command and the authority coming through that center. The Arjuna here is an authority center. The great militaries always practice behind that center because it gives power to give orders. And the great sages prefer this one because they don't want to give any orders. But if you can get here, you're doing very well, to center yourself before you become absolute, just center yourself as an authority in your own life. Get used to that and hang all the being. Remember, you're a hanged man. This is another aspect of the hanged man. And think that, really, when you stretch the spine, you are doing so. I hope my hair's sticking. When you stretch your spine in that way, you are doing so because an energy in you is anti-gravitational. Think that's it's a real statement. To stretch the spine is to open a door of an anti-gravitational force. Something in us that is not going. See, that's a gravitational force. Think that there is something up there that has come to the earth and lifted something up out of the earth. A plant, an animal, a human being, and wants to lift that human being to a proper level. Turn a man into a human. Into his fullness, there. So that when you lift yourself smoothly and gently, no rigidity, you are actually using an energy that's coming from this six-pointed star down the spinal axis and circulates around it, polarizes every part of it, and that alone, if you do nothing egotistically stupid against it, will organize and order the whole body without anything else. And if you allow that spinal posture to begin to sag, even at the gross mechanical level, the vertebrae are separate and they'll lean over and you'll get discs floating out to right and left and so on, and you'll trap nerves and you'll decrease circulation, the organism will suffer mechanically. But not only that, you will suffer psychically, because remember that the soul has been put into a physical body so that you can build a spiritual body out of the physical. Your spiritual body is the form that you are building into the soul by means of the physical body. So first have to be a physical body, and then the processes in the physical body strike a light and it becomes a soul. Solo being a solo will, solo understanding. And then it has to be elevated to the point where it becomes cosmically conscious, out of the actual matter of the body. The chemistry of a man who has become wise isn't the same as it was when he was ignorant. A an Abyssinian priest spits on the face. Now, we might think he's rude, but a good priest has a very good spit. Even ordinary people's spit's quite good for tender eyes, you know. It's a wonderful thing. You put it on a cat, it's about the best thing you can do. So, it's a healing thing. He's not meant it as a salt of other things. So you see that the whole organism itself is produced by two forces. Let's have a little drawing, shall we? Can we come down this way? How about handling this? You know?
Yeah.
I bet I'm going to handle this next week. If I have to.
Professor Haldeman, I'll ask a question before you quite leave. This process of retaining energy is a conscious process. One must have the information to be able to practice this.
Yeah.
There are people you meet who seem to have an unconscious ability to absorb insults. People who one would say were good-natured. Some people seem to be able to take this to a high level. Is this possible to get anything unconsciously?
Let's have a look at some of those people. There are some people who actually don't know when they're insulted. There are such people. You say something and it's over their head literally. That's one type. There's another kind, we call them the Venus type. And although they have a vague idea that you're intending to be inimical, they happen to be fluid in the psyche. So whatever you say, as it goes in, unbecomes form, it's dissolved. It's lost in them, literally, to them. And immediately their own nature, their own inertia, not their own will, their inertia reasserts itself. And to them it's a fresh start. They're the Venus type. They're generally fair. And a certain kind of translucence about the flesh. They look like true Venusians, you know. They look very, very nice, very, very placid. They're hard to insult, because whatever you say is form, and they are not formed beings. And whatever you put in them, an insult is always a form, you know. Whatever you put in them, they immediately dissolve it. Just if you've got a bit of salt, that's form, that's in it. Drop it in the water. And they look for it. Where is it? It's all over. And the water doesn't know anything about it. It's been distributed and equilibrated as if it had never been. So you come tomorrow and you apologize, and she doesn't know what for. Literally. Now, it won't do. It's not what we want. And it isn't the same thing as conscious willed continence. What we want is the ability consciously to get an insult, an in-jumped energy, and to bring it round, use it as a meditation energy on the nature of the significance of the insult and not let it happen. That's the method. To take the insult and immediately universalize it. So the fellow says, you flat-footed. You see, and you immediately think, flat foot now. That's an insult. I suppose the foot shouldn't be flat. It should be arched. Why arched? Arches are very strong, aren't they? You can put terrific weight on an arch. And the arch of the foot is a good arch, very strong and very springy. It's very, very good, you see. In fact, without an arch in the foot, we don't walk very well. And use up all the energy of the insult to universalize the proposition, mechanical, geometrical, and so on. You have then grown, and they have worked for you. They don't know it, and they're not getting paid. They're secret slaves. It's part of what is called the tacit conspiracy. Yeah, I was going to move up to you. Here is the earth as we know it. I want you now to imagine this is a diaphragm. And the diaphragm goes all the way around. So this is like the gross material of the body. And inside that, there's a worm. Which continuously trying to force its way out through the earth, producing volcanic eruptions. Over here is an absolute sun, and down here another sun, the one that shines on our earth. There are innumerable other complications, but we'll keep it simple. This force is coming very, very gently straight through the whole lot. Light, absolute, is shining in this darkness, and that darkness is not comprehending the light. And it cannot from itself get out because it is covetous, it is egotistic, it is dragging in all the time to the center and trying to eat infinity. It is taking everything that falls to it and packing it. It is gravity, gravity. It is the zone of death. It is trying to kill everything and reduce everything that comes to it to food, and by turbulating inside to digest it and to drag in more. Now that is an initial will called the Saturnine impression to existence, and that will arose in the absolute. The absolute is the Father, and soul, the Son, and the Lute is the ghost or spirit. The absolute is a threefold aspected reality, incomprehensible to this finited gross being, and yet this being arose within it, which means that it was a potential of the absolute to cause existences. So there's an equation between the ab in absolute, the Father, as the generator, and the devil as he who has this whole world in his grip, because the grip is the creative fiat, the force that is holding everything together, the force of coherence of all beings, the cause of our physical body. The fact that our physical body is a persistent stimulus to us, it's a nuisance, it's a devil. Nevertheless, it has a purpose. The devil is let loose for a time, time and a half time, and so on. Now, that grip could not be broken by this absolute force because it is totally unaware of it. So a mediating force has to be set up of such a low vibration relatively to this absolute one that its impulse is coming onto the earth. Break it up. They produce changes in it. And they begin, these solar forces, to activate on the earth, and in conjunction with the lunar forces, which are rotating around it, and acting upon the fluids, the two of them together, as positive and negative, produce here organization of being. You know that all the form that is on earth is light form involved and aided by the substantial reinforcing influences of the moon. So we have a negative substantial body aspect and a positive radiating force aspect of will in our own organism. This solar energy has broken down the earth and produced plants growing up. In conjunction with the effect of the moon on the fluids in the plants, it has produced organic meat, and through processes it has produced an animal, and it has produced man. The forces here are mediating forces, saving forces. Therefore there's an equation between the S-U-N and the S-O-N. The sun is the sun. So it is said quite accurately that the primitive people who were sun worshippers were accurate to worship the sun, because it was actually the saviour of the human race at that level of consciousness. It and its force coming in gave them the possibility of attaining consciousness, clarity, and so on, and it organized with the moon flux the chemicals in the fluids and produced organic life, and is in process of lifting. Now you can see from that diagram the meaning of the two paths in the Hindu system, and the sun path, Suryayana, and the Pitriyana, the moon path. a person is either needing further physical evolution or considers itself now ready for volitional freedom. If it considers itself materially needing further experience, its consciousness is always turning back onto the earth. It is an earthbound consciousness. Now the dominion of the Saturnine impression is up to the limit of the moon. This is why Gurdjieff places the moon as a term. The forces, gravitational, go up to the level of the moon. The moon is circulating, captured by the earth, so that if any person who has formed a body out of his gross material body is still interested in the earth, when those aspects which organize him lift him out of the body of death, when they lift him, his interest curves him, and he goes no farther than the sphere of the moon. And he rotates in this pitriana, this moon sphere, and he goes on rotating round here for a period until he has absorbed the significance of the experiences that he had derived from his five sense life. When their significance is exhausted, he falls again and reincarnates. And that is the meaning of the pitriana. You get interested in the material world and you want to come back. The solar energy, which gave you all the light and the understanding, because you didn't develop it enough, it hasn't enough influence on you. You leave the body, you rise, but you can't climb beyond the lunar sphere. So you rotate within that sphere. I have put it diagrammatically there, it's more complicated than that. Imagine a zone around the earth in which the moon is circulating as a special frequency band. Every height from the earth has its own frequency. It is a special frequency band. And the person still interested in the earth and in physical generation cannot go beyond it. So he circulates round there with the moon until he has exhausted the interest of his previous earth experience. He then feels faint. He hasn't got any further kick. So he cannot keep circulating round there anymore. He hasn't got the energy to do it. He needs a certain amount of energy to carry him into that sphere. So he loses impetus, and he then falls into the earth, and somewhere some other person with the same tendencies is very, very busy creating a body into which that soul falls and is then reincarnated. That is the lot of every person still interested in the earth and in physical generation. There are two ways of being interested in physical generation. One is because you're interested in it for its fun and games aspect, the sensual interest, and the other is because the Messiah has got to be born physiologically and there's a duty to be done. There aren't many people that have this duty concept, but no person who is tied by the earth can go beyond there. But a being who has got the power from the sun in the will such that he has broken his terrestrial interest, at death he goes to the sun, and now he circulates, you know, the sun is traveling, he circulates in the sphere of the sun. He could, if he willed, and occasionally some do, will back to the earth to help some of those pitrionic beings and remind them there is something other than this. Now there is a great cyclical process such that from the moment of the compression of the earth, a definite amount of energy is involved in the initial compression, and therefore a definite temporal development, and therefore a possibility of prophecy, because the cycle is determined by the initial amount of energy involved in it. And when all that energy has fulfilled its purpose, such that no further interest is held by the beings on it for the earth, then the Saturnine impression is broken the earth incandesces and becomes a sun, and all the beings then on it are volitional, by which time that moon will have moved out and constitute a new earth, and a new centre will be formed around that with a new moon on it. The process is eternal. Now, there's no hurry. You see, it's important to realise that time has its purpose. Saturn, the principle of time, Cronos, Saturn, Cronos, is in order that you should develop free will. His worship, the Absolute, his worship is perfect freedom. He doesn't care how long you take, because you can only take time. And he doesn't function in time, he functions eternally. We don't want to get out quicker than we can get out properly. So we're not going to panic about it. But we're not going to do what the Hindus did with their concept of reincarnation and say we won't bother this time, we'll do a bit next time. We are actually going to prefer, because of certain evolutionary forces involved in us, by the error of the Hindus. We are the recipients of their errors, and therefore of the benefits of the errors. We are going to climb out and prefer to be free. The concept of free self-determination, not lower egoic determination, that is reaction. Free will, self with a capital S. We are going to do that. In order to do it, we must understand that whenever there is a material hard surface like that, the skin on an apple, the skull in the head, and so on, it means that there is a force coming down and a force inside trying to push it out. There's an egoic center. And that is a firmament. And this is the waters below the firmament, this is the waters above the firmament. And we have to bring all this into our consciousness so that we do not try to get rid of bondage prematurely. We deliberately work on the physical body we have in the only profitable way of working. That is, we use the body as a permanent reference point. We know it's satanic. Satanic. S. T. And motion. The self crucified serpent. That is Satan. We know that it's satanic because nothing could constrain it to crucify. It has compressed itself and crucified itself. And as we saw last week, we are responsible for our own existence. We have will to exist. We are responsible for us. And therefore, we should accept the limitations imposed on us simply because they annoy the appetite in us. Because out of the annoyance, or the angst and sorrow, the turbulence of our central serpent, eventually comes the flash of realization. It cannot come any other way. So every bit of friction, every kind of opposition we can get from other people without energy expenditure exceedingly from us is again and a movement towards ultimate condescence. When that condescence occurs properly and we have this in our mind, what is called Purana, perfect crystallization of the soul occurs. And all wise men are identical. They can't be egotistic because what they know is the same as everyone knows, namely the Absolute of us. Whereas, if we take the five-point in and integrate on that, it is a false integration. Because the finite, five sense, has been fed serially in the time process and is necessarily wrong. So that to formulate prematurely out of your five sense dika is to create a hell body for yourself. So we don't want to do it. What we want to understand is nothing less than the Absolute. And the Absolute appears to us as a primary polarization in order to appear. It is going to be appearance. A biratio function, a rationally graspable proposition that must polarize itself as energy and substance. those two aspects of a non-rational, not an irrational, a non-rational, non-ratioed reality. That is the egg. This is the pure crystal body, the Vajra, also the thunderbolt body you find in Buddhism. It is the pure light body of many Christian esotericists and so on. It is crystalline, it is like a diamond, it is hard, it is all sorts of things from different aspects, because it is unbreakable, because it is a realization of the absolute non-discrete source of all things. The absolute is not made of parts. It's a non-discrete reality. The L in it is the non-discretion. The apparent discretion is the R in real. It is simply a vibration. So if you want to pronounce, there's the root of the mouth, the firmament in the head, there is the tongue, we put them up there. If we let it rattle, it's the letter R. If we just drag it along, it's L. When it rattles, it means to differentiate. When it drags, it means to join together. It is formed in exactly the same place on the palate, and therefore the word real is really one letter, appearing as a link synthetic factor and differentiated elements to be linked, presupposing a pre-analysis absolute reality, appearing in the time process as elements projected temporally, serially, and then linked together, and in the linkage synthesizing a whole made out of discrete elements. And the synthetic whole is the discrete elements plus the awareness of the absolute reality behind it. Now that is real. And this lore of the ancients is exactly the same thing. The lore or wisdom of the ancients is simply, it's different, not different. The law that we know of is based on this. The law of man is derived in bits from it. Law is all the same. This, we can create a difference in this case. You see, there's a way whereby we can define the situation, because it's all the same, really. Those people who can't differentiate will pay fees to those who can, and those who cannot differentiate are like L instead of R. Now you'll notice that when a child cannot differentiate properly, it says L. You can't say this, it says that. You notice that certain people, like the Parisians and the Austrians and others, pronounce an R on the soft palate, as opposed to a Scottish one on the tip. The nearer it is to the teeth, the more intellectual it is. So a trilled R on the teeth is intellectual differentiation, and a uvular R, where the uvula flaps in the breeze, is only gullical differentiation. It's a primary differentiation of the gullet that's occurring. It isn't as clear as the one that you do on your teeth. And you'll notice in general, people in southern parts are less forward than they are on the teeth. Because the northern parts are harder, the terrain is harder, the living is harder. You've got to discriminate more. Where it's easy, there's less necessity for discrimination, and lazy art comes. You can hardly pronounce it, unless there's a need for differentiation. So, that again is a good reminder. The word real, the word lore, the old form of it, the lar, is a nice place in Scotland called Largs. And if you go there, you will find some pillars with funny measurements. And they give you evidence of exactly the same law. And this lovely word where this G becomes K, lark, is exactly the same thing. The lark that goes in the sky is derived from the same idea. A lark is simply an intellectual play, as opposed to a lark, which is a gross material application. So for a lark, first of all you must know the lark, the gross law, and then you must insert a little twist, an intellectual twist into it. See it in a new way, that's called a lark.
That little dicky bird that flies off the surface of the earth like this is really driven by a force, a solar force. Let this dicky bird rise this way now. And when the little lark is up there,
it has actually been elevated by a light force from the sun, which you can hear trilling in it, shouting R on the top of its voice,
and going up and up and up and up until it's tired and comes down again.
It's actually lifted.
Now, remember that these forces are the forces that are lifting the plant world, the animal world, the man world, and they're being opposed for a time, times and half a time.
That's three and a half, isn't it?
So that the process and the purpose of the gross material world shall be fulfilled. When it is all fulfilled, that is the consummation day. The adding up of the little impulses that were predicted in, then fly out again. Incandescence, release. Then that sun is the centre, the throne spirit, round which are other beings in their hierarchies, up to the limit where the planet is, and a change of phase where that planet is, and then another planet of different density and so on. Now, is that fairly clear?
Would you think Appetite 3, as you mentioned there, with the Suryama, after the reciprocal feeding principle?
The recognition of it?
Yes.
Yes. Because if you don't realise that actually you are biting yourself, if you bite another person, it is only because they have made you realise that you are impotent. You have no other reason to bite them. If they remind you of your deficiencies, then you bite them. Really, you're biting yourself, but you can't inhibit it. You haven't the power, so it flies out and bites that person. And as soon as it's bitten, if you're watching, you know you made a mistake. It should have been turned back on you and bitten you and said, that was a wrong technique at least. How to do it better next time? The whole of the law consists in catching that thing and bringing it back. Bring it back. Reflection.
On the drawing underneath there, you know, so I put the man bent round the zodiac and the feet protects our memories, I think. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The feet were touching the head. The feet are under the dominion of Pisces, fish, which means emotions. The emotional life expresses itself in wigglings of the toes at its turn. The more you try to control it up here, the more it is forced down the body, and so you get leg reflex and so on. So if you place the whole man round there, the genital centre is in Scorpio, under the dominion of Mars. The initial energies of Aries are also under the dominion of Mars. Fiery energy in the absolute has bound itself in Taurus, has divided itself in Gemini. One half has chased the other half in Cancer. This Cancer sign, you see, is that. One part is trying to eat the other part. There's two fish, two claws, and one crab and so on. One part is pursuing the other part, in the same way that the nervous system is pursuing the blood system, and the blood system is pursuing the nervous system. And this is the cause of the generation, as the Chinese version of it. And then, in that capturing, is the soulish life, the flash. And that light then goes into Leo, where the being becomes a being, light, and conscious that to him there's nothing so important as to be free. So a person born in Leo has freedom, but he cannot really operate except from himself. He's gone beyond the level where he can be merely passive, he must do so. Because he's a will being, he wills to complete his education. He wills into Virgo. Now that's all around the tummy, the navel, and the intestine, and the like.
And willing into that, he's absorbing, and he then has to balance in Nibba. Whatever comes into him then, he must equilibrate it, balance it, assess it, weigh it, etc. When it is weighed, he will then decide that some of it is worthy of generation. And the generation can be either in an external physical act, a demonstration of the truth, or it can be sexually, when you make a gross physical body for another soul to inhabit. The choice appropriate to you, if you remember the aim, which is Sagittarian. The thighs are the recipients of the main drives to go, so that this energy applied shall be feathered. And it pushes you into a situation where the knees in Capricorn are brought to bend. You know, at the back of the neck, the popliteal arch and the hamstrings. If you want to drive into a situation, you must bend the knee, because the situation exists. You must accept it. You find people getting stiff knees when they are in the situation that they are refusing.
The tape at this point ran out, the original tape. So I'm presenting a resume of how the work developed from this point. We've seen that in Libra, certain choices have been made. And now in Sagittarius, we see the choice appropriate to you. If you remember the aim, which is Sagittarius, the thighs are the recipients of the main drives to go, so that this energy applied shall be furthered if it pushes you into a situation where the knees in Capricorn are brought to bend. If you want to drive into a situation, you must bend the knee, because the situation exists. You must accept it. You find people getting stiff knees when they're in a situation that they're refusing. So here in Capricorn, the cardinal earth sign, which as we know symbolizes a stress on the material absorption, such people are orientated towards the gross material world. We refer to it for authority for their position. And if we compare it with the one immediately opposite, Cancer, which is the cardinal water sign, symbolizes the feeling life, this person does not refer to the external world, but to his own feelings for authority. In relationship, the Capricornian would say, I know so-and-so, because it exists in the material world, and I require you to recognize the material world as an essential reference point. I remember they're talking to the Cancer feeling type. They could go on to say, you must be practical. It must be down to earth. Well, the Cancer might reply, I'm not concerned with the external material world, but with my feelings. Because although the material world may exist, as far as I'm concerned, it has no value unless I feel it to have. Thus the Cancer type refuses to accept as basic that which the Capricorn type calls fundamental. So until they could agree on a common basis, there could be no possible understanding between them. It's as if a welfare worker, a Capricornian, say, goes to visit a cancer type. The welfare worker will say, we must be practical. We must realize that we live in a material world. So we must take care of the material facts of life and put them in order. We must conform to the social structure in which we live. The cancer type would immediately feel that everything that had been said was irrelevant to the inner state of his cancer position. Now, when we start to apply a force in the form of words to a being, we are starting to shift the stress of that being, and there will arise in his consciousness different contents according to the stimuli presented. We must therefore familiarize ourselves with the meaning of every term. And when listening to another person, try to place the center out of which the statement he makes is coming. So if we use the example we've just used, if a person does start to talk about material security and the necessity for accepting things that come to us and absorbing them, then we will know that the earth triad in that being is speaking.